husband is dead. When she spoke the words, they crowded her consciousness, blotting out the moments of love and acceptance mere minutes before. Walter became very still.
Oh, no. Oh, no. What happened?
Emma sat down heavily, her hands to her face.
The rain? The flooded creeks?
Yes, yes. He rode with a group of men here to Lancaster to reinforce the lower parts with sandbags. His horse shied going across a bridge and threw him against the bridge's stone foundation.
Dead instantly?
No, he lived for 11 days. He never woke up.
Oh, mein Herr! An act of God! An act of God!
Hester nodded. Guilt flooded her eyes. Emma spoke on, freely and openly.
God took him. He did.
That's good. He was not for you. It was not his will that you marry him. Walter came to stand behind Emma's chair. He reached out a hand and patted her round shoulder.
Now, now, Emma, my dear.
Hester's mouth opened in surprise when Emma reached up to clasp the round fingers placed on her shoulders and kept them there.
What?
Hester could not put words to the question, so she gestured toward the clasped hands.
Oh!
Emma and Walter said, with one voice and a great display of merriment. Their pink faces were wreathed in smiles, all the aging lines and wrinkles turning into little trails of happiness.
You don't know!
Why, of course not. Walter asked me to marry him after Billy ran off to the war.
Oh, and you don't know about that either!
Emma burst out. And so began a long tale, a story spun into emotional clouds of longing for Billy. Newly discovered marital bliss, the blessings received from the Lord for their marriage, and spending their days together in gratitude.
But you didn't like Walter,
Hester stated, laughing.
Indeed, indeed. Were it not for Billy's leaving, I would not have my darling Emma.
Walter, always the well-bred gentleman, patted her arm reassuringly.
That in my wash line,
Emma chirped.
How I hated the fact that Walter could see my nightclothes flapping on the line. It was downright immodest. And it never failed. I'd hang them out, and there he was like a nosy gopher up over the top of that fence.
Walter laughed, and his tears ran copiously as he held his rotund stomach.
Now, Emma, I never looked at your wash line.
Puh, that is a schnitzer.
Billy got himself in trouble down at the livery. He punched a drunken man in the stomach, then let his horse loose. He had fines to pay after his arrest and couldn't go back to the livery ever. He almost landed in the stocks on the square. Emma shook her head as sorrow filled her deep-set eyes. She clucked and lamented, but he was gone now.
Old enough he was, and fit as a fiddle, that boy. Strong in the legs like a draft horse. He could run for miles without being winded. He'd make a good soldier, but any day he might be killed.
Emma could hardly live with that. Walter added solemnly that as long as the French supported the Indians to the north, and they fought the English colonists this way, the war would continue. It all boiled down to the lust for land. The Indians had been driven to Pennsylvania from the south, and here they had been wiped out, driven west to Ohio and beyond. Then Hester began her story, her marriage to William, her failure to give William children, his stringent rules and exacting nature. Walter and Emma allowed Hester to continue unhindered, giving no indication of their opinions. They drank cup after cup of tea, snipping off so much sugar with each cup that the solid white cone was disappearing rapidly, which seemed quite wasteful to Hester. But she must remember these were English people, not frugal Amish. So she allowed Emma to place a large piece of white sugar in her own tea, sipped it with relish, and pronounced it very good. Frances would have a fit. The last of her story was her plan to travel to Ohio to look for her people. She presented her case well, without seeking pity, stating her inability to be a good wife to William because of her Indian heritage. The loud ticking of the clock was the only sound in the homey kitchen. The candlelight cast the whole room into the warmth of its yellow glow. The kettle purred on the lid of the cast-iron stove. The checked tablecloth was covered with molasses cookies and tea, the cone of sugar, and a white milk pitcher, so much like Kate's kitchen. The only thing missing was children. A baby in the cradle. There had always been babies, and Kate's devotion to them. Walter sighed, and his great bald head swiveled from side to side. He stood up.
I'll tend to your horse, Hester. She must be thirsty.
Hester nodded. Her eyes were bright with unshed tears, her mouth soft and trembling. Emma was careful with her words. She chose them deliberately, while letting Hester know that she had done nothing wrong. In fact, she had done well. God had chosen to take William, yes, but not by her sins, or because of them. And there was no way on earth she could allow Hester to travel west, a young woman alone. She wouldn't last 2 weeks before some ruffian would make off with her horse, and perhaps even herself.
Hester, my dearest heart, you must finally make peace with who you are. An Indian, yes. There is nothing wrong with being one. And you were Amish raised by a loving Kate? And you've lived with Hans, Annie, William, and Francis, all created by God, too, living here by the grace of God. Imperfect, yes. Perfectly lovable, no. Blaming yourself has got to go. None of this is a fault of your own. But if you want to hang on to that whole misery, then go right ahead.
Hester cowered beneath Emma's forthright nature. Stop running away.
But I'm not. Yes, you are. But it's for the best. Do you really want to go?
Emma's beady blue eyes shot darts of truth. When they hit their mark, Hester's shoulders sagged and her face relaxed, as warm, healing tears appeared in her black eyes. They hung like silver jewels on the thick, dark lashes, trembled, and then splashed on her cheeks and down the front of her black dress, where they soaked into the fabric, turning it darker than it was. What followed was a shock to Emma. She had never heard weeping become so forceful. The sobs of anger emitted from her open mouth, the hoarse heaves of sadness and misery propelled by the power of her guilt and misplaced blame, were frightening. In simple language, Emma urged Hester to grasp forgiveness and draw on God's unlimited supply of grace. Slowly, she dismantled all the explanations and resolve Hester had created to explain what she had experienced. Emma held her, letting her sobs enter her own heart, and cried with her. Walter's small eyes filled up as he came through the door, and he cried as he filled the teacups. He cried as he sliced ham into the frying pan, sniffed as he seasoned the beans, and wiped at tears that plunked into the water in the dishpan as he peeled potatoes. For he loved Hester so much. She went home in the fading gray light, the rain splashing on the buggy top and the little brown mare named Fanny. She told Elias and Francis of her plans to move into Emma Ferry's house, the empty one beside Walter and Emma Trout. Quite simply, she wanted to be with them. No, she would not attend church every time, but she would remain true to the Amish faith. Emma thought it would be best. Barbara King came to visit on Sunday, early, before the hordes of others arrived who had come to wish the young widow well. She came in on the stiff April wind, the kind that bent tulips double, flopping them against the side of the stone house, brushing their delicate petals. She whirled through the door and banged it shut behind her, latched it with a loud ring of iron, and turned to the fireplace, rubbing her hands furiously. Hester rose immediately, her black dress swishing about her narrow hips as she used the bellows to stir up the fire.
Chilly out there.
Barbara handed her stiff black hat to Hester, loosened the long steel pin so she could slide the black shawl off her shoulders, folded it expertly, and gave it to Hester as well.
How's it going, Hester? I think of you every night.
Good, Barbara. It's
call me Buppy.
Buppy? I went to visit an old friend, Emma Ferry, and her new husband, and she helped me out of a few dumb cough decisions.
Don't you know the old saying, no decisions for a year when a spouse passes away?
What? A year? A whole year to live here with Johnny and Naomi? I can't.
Hester whispered her defeat.
Why not? You've got it made. Big stone house, money, Francis at your beck and call.
Hester told Buppy about Johnny and Naomi and the farm.
You're not thinking straight, Hester. Take the farm.
I don't want it.
Buppy looked thoughtfully at Hester. her bright brown eyes polished with understanding. Then she nodded firmly, signaling her empathy. Hester's heart relaxed in the strength of knowing that Buppy, Emma, and Walter all stood with her.
You're right. You shouldn't accept the farm.
I'm going to live with, well, not with Walter and Emma, but in the empty house beside them, in the town of Lancaster on Mulberry Street.
Up went Buppy's eyebrows. What will you do for a living?
They won't charge me rent. I'll make quilts. She kept her love of herbs and doctoring hidden from Buppy.
I was hoping you would consent to live with me.
Buppy spoke softly, so unlike her. Hester saw the disappointment in her eyes, the dejection in her shoulders. Hester wavered in her decision. Should she accept her offer first? Indecision cracked the shaky new foundation Emma had placed beneath her so firmly only a few days ago.
Suddenly, Buppy sat upright, shrugged her shoulders, and said it was all right. She'd always done well on her own and would continue to. I go to Lancaster's Curb Market, selling garden things. I'll see you on Friday and Saturday sometimes, maybe?
In that moment, Hester told her of the herbs, her plans to grow them, to bottle tinctures and teas, and to go wherever there was a need, and how William had not wanted her to do this. Buppy was enthralled. She asked dozens of questions, saying the need for a service such as she spoke of was large and growing.
Is there room for a garden in the back lot of Emma Ferry's house?
Buppy asked finally. Hester considered, mulling over the fact that she did not really know this Barbara King, a distant relative of William's. She watched the woman warily. Reddish hair, a nose like a hawk, observant eyes, a long and lean and narrow face like William's and Francis's. The only thing soft about Buppy was her eyes, bright like polished stones, but guileless, and yes, soft. She was all sharp angles, no womanly curves anywhere, her black dress hanging as if from a coat rack, loose, empty, almost rectangular. Finally, Hester decided the best way was total honesty. She had been betrayed too often. Are you a cousin of Francis?
First cousin not to her, but to Elias.
So how do I know you're nice, like him? At this, Buppy hooted a strange laugh, almost like a screech owl at night or the clumsy squawk of the nighthawk.
Hester, you're odd. You can't go tiptoeing through life afraid everyone is not nice. Very few people are. Don't be so serious. You wear your cap so far over your ears, every bit of your hair is covered. Who made you do that? Or were you always so plain or whatever?
William was very conservative.
May he rest in peace.
Buppy said softly, but her eyes flashed without piety.
I can bet a nickel that man was very much like his mother.
The words were out of her mouth before she could grab them back. Up went the hand, sideways across her mouth, her brown eyes like glistening river pebbles.
Sorry.
Hester shook her head, a smile curving her lips.
You know how beautiful you are, don't you?
Buppy asked. Hester frowned and her eyebrows fell, a straight black line over brooding eyes. Beauty is a curse. Buppy stared at her, unblinking.
You really do believe that?
Of course I do.
Why?
Someday I'll tell you.
Someday? Does that mean you're asking me to live in Emma Ferry's house in town?
Are Amish women allowed to live in town? Does our Ordnung forbid it? Buppy's eyes turned bright with humor.
We'll never know until we try it, will we?
When the spring rains turned to the heat of summer, Emma Ferry's house was newly whitewashed, the windows polished, the floors scrubbed. There was new ticking in the mattresses. The fireplace was cleaned and whitewashed. Walter Trout repaired the front door, his face red and streaming in the summer sun. Hester accompanied Buppy to her house in the country, a low dwelling built of logs, fashioned in a peculiar style without an upstairs. It was extremely small, but sufficient for one person. It was built on the south corner of her brother Samuel's farm, a former hut built by an earlier owner to house slaves. Buppy had beautiful furniture for a single woman, fashioned in the old German style with intricate scrollwork. The blanket chests and cupboard doors were painted with delicate motifs carefully preserved from the old country. Buppy put Hester to work cleaning the furniture with oil soap, then polishing it with sheep's wool. They packed it well, with heavy blankets on a farm wagon Johnny loaned them. The massive Belgians stood, their heads drooping patiently as he helped them load the valuable pieces. He remained a gentleman, so impressing Buppy that she became quite flustered when she spoke to him. Hester sat perched on a wooden chest. The sun had climbed high at the noon hour. Heat shimmered across the cornfields. Bright butterflies hovered among the columbine, delicately feeding on the thin nectar of the lavender flowers, bobbing in the stillness. A meadowlark sang its lusty song, opening its bill like a pair of scissors. Chimney swifts wheeled in the hot, cloudless sky, dozens of them dipping and wheeling as one. Today, there was a song in Hester's heart, an old tune Kate used to sing while doing the wash. It welled up until Hester was humming softly so no one would hear. She lifted her face to the sun, glorying in the summer scents of the earth and the verdant crops, growing so lush and green. Here, men's axes had laid the heavy trees to the ground. Then they'd used the lumber to build barns and houses for their growing families, a way of life Hester knew well. Foreign to her was the way of the nomadic Indian, she recognized. Over and over, gratitude for Emma Ferry's sound advice lifted Hester's spirits. Elias and Francis sent her away, wishing her the blessing, Herr Zaya, as they clasped her hands warmly in their own. Francis was glad to be rid of her, she knew. But still, Hester admired the effort she put forth to stand beside her husband and wish her the usual German blessing. Naomi said she must come often to visit. Johnny shook her hand, holding it longer than necessary. But she endured his touch, shaking off the repulsiveness. To forgive, to let go, was the Amish way, and the way of all Christians who chose to follow Jesus' teaching. Buppy turned.
You still back there?
Hester acknowledged her words with a wave. Walter and Emma awaited them, motioning them to the back alley. Walter helped Buppy guide the horses carefully to the back door, and the work of unloading the furniture began. They filled the house with the beautiful German pieces. They scattered bright hooked rugs of blue and purple, yellow and red across polished oak floors. Hester put her wedding gifts, the towels and tablecloths, doilies and rugs that were made of rushes, with Buppy's things. She placed the set of china with the blue pattern on the cupboard shelves alongside Buppy's set of white dishes. Francis gave her William's desk and his rocking chair, tears streaming as she presented them to Hester. Her mouth compressed piously when she asked her to take good care of them. They put the desk in the living room with the rocking chair beside it. Hester placed one of her glass vases on the desktop, then picked a bouquet of white daisies to remember William. She could picture him rocking by the fireplace, content after supper, his dark head bent over the massive Bible on his lap. Buppy laid a small fire in the fireplace and made tea for her helpers. Walter and Emma sat side by side on the bench, watching with eager eyes as she cut a strawberry pie. Shoveling huge wedges onto the pretty blue dishes, Buppy winked broadly at Hester as Walter and Emma began enjoying the sweet dessert. Hester smiled, bending quickly to fold a tea towel into the cupboard drawer. She had the distinct feeling that life could become extremely interesting with Buppy, Walter, and Emma. Every week, they drove Buppy's team out to the homestead, as she called the house that was barely more than a hut. There they weeded and hoed the huge vegetable garden, toiling side by side in the blazing sun. They picked the vegetables that were ripe, set traps for marauding raccoons and opossums, then loaded the week's supply of vegetables for the downtown market. On the curb, they set up wooden crates, then piled the freshly picked beans, red beets, and cucumbers in pleasing mounds. The tops of the beets dripping with fresh water, the way the townsfolk wanted them, Buppy said. Customers came, looked, and voiced their pleasure at Buppy's fine vegetables.
No, she'd say, I'll have cabbage next week.
Lifting her thumb and forefinger, she squeezed her eyes shut to mimic how very close the cabbage heads were to being the perfect size, but not quite yet. She was noisy, her voice rising above the cartwheels, the hooves of the horses, the other sellers hawking their wares. She flung her cap strings over her square shoulders. Her coppery hair gleamed from beneath the wide expanse of muslin, her bright eyes never missing a potential buyer. She sold peas in the pod for exorbitant prices, and raspberries fat and black and luscious with moisture. Wealthy, fair-skinned ladies fought for her smallest cucumbers, her ruffled heads of lettuce. Hester helped to set up and kept the piles looking fresh and succulent, her large, dark eyes taking in the way Buppy did business. The men came, staring at Hester, then looked away respectfully, bending to the wishes of their wives, although many discreetly glanced backward at the beauty of the new Amish girl. Buppy howled with unashamed glee as she loaded up the empty crates. Passersby frowned at the raucous sound, unable to believe their eyes and ears at that unmannerly vegetable seller. But Buppy sold every morsel, every leaf she brought. She and Hester counted the money at the kitchen table after the sun had gone down. Buppy leaned back in her chair, a pleased expression spreading across her features.
"We're all set, Hester. We'll put enough by to hold us over the winter. I never sold so many vegetables. All you have to do is perch on a crate and look at the crowd."
She leaned forward, slapped the table, and said Frances would have a fit now, wouldn't she? Chapter 18. In August, the sweet corn ripened. Row after row, the tall, heavy stalks each contained one ear of corn, the kernels plump and moist, the silk blackening as the ears became ripe. So much corn required the heavy farm wagon and two Belgians, which took Buppy immediately to Johnny and Naomi's front door in spite of Hester's disapproval. When Hester refused to accompany her, Buppy drove off in a tiff, her cap strings flying out behind the back seat of Walter Trout's one-seated buggy. Leaning forward, she wrapped the silver mare to a fast trot, muttering to herself about stubborn Indian blood. Hester watched her go, her arms crossed tightly about her waist, her eyes flashing black heat. If Buppy insisted on hiring that offensive Johnny to haul her corn to market, she'd have to do it alone. Hester was not prepared to work freely in his presence. The moving had been bad enough. That Buppy certainly did have a mind of her own. The dew was heavy. So heavy, in fact, that by the time Buppy and Hester made their way down the first and second rows of sweet corn, they were soaked. Their kerchiefs clung to their sodden hair. The corn tassels dusted their heads with clinging yellow pods. The corn stalks were wet and itchy, scraping their necks and faces like rasping claws. They made sacks out of their aprons, holding up the bottoms by two corners until they bulged with ears of corn, dew-laden and heavy. Buppy was frenzied in her movements, yanking the corn off the heavy stalks and filling her apron twice as fast as Hester. "This corn may as well be made of gold," she crowed, her breath coming in gasps. "It's about as heavy," Hester called. She was happy working in the early morning. Johnny had not showed up, thankfully allowing them the use of the wagon without his assistance. Up and down the rows, the women toiled, loading the large green ears on the bed of the wagon. The sun was a pulsing red orb in a yellow sky that already reflected its heat. Not a cloud was in sight, not so much as a small breeze moved the wet corn stalks. Hester figured that if the wet heat continued, they'd have a thunderstorm. She eyed the perfectly staked tomatoes, the heavy, prickly vines of the cucumber plants, then lifted a hand to shade her eyes as she looked toward the sun. There it was. To the left of the sun was a brilliant flash of light like an uncolored rainbow, the harbinger of rain, the sun dog. Well, if the rainstorm came, they'd dig the vegetables out of the mud the way Kate used to. Her thoughts were not on the mundane task of ripping off ears of corn, when suddenly a solid form ahead startled her so that she drew back, her eyes wide with alarm. "Oh!" His grin spreading widely, Johnny stood at the end of the row, his thumbs hooked in the side pockets of his broadfall trousers. "Hester, didn't mean to scare you." His teeth flashed white in his dark face, the straw hat pulled low, his hair as dark as midnight, so like William's. Hester said nothing, bending her head to her task. He refused to move, to allow her to step out of the row. His dark eyes glittered,
black coals shaded by the filthy straw hat. He opened his mouth to speak. The black coals turned to slits.
"You can't always hide," he sneered.
"Johnny!"
Buppy's joyous greeting rang from a short distance away.
He turned and patiently hailed Buppy, warmly lifting a hand in greeting.
Buppy stumbled over her words, so effusive was her welcome. Johnny grinned, praising her growing of the vegetables, and said he'd never seen nicer corn. She'd get a good price today.
Hester turned down another row. Her apron was bulging with the heavy ears, her dress was soaking wet, and she had no plans to step out for that man's inspection. Discreetly, she emptied her apron in between the rows of corn and kept pulling ears, moving away from their voices.
"Hester!"
Buppy's sharp call stopped her short. Slowly, she emptied another apron load of corn, straightened, and resumed picking furiously. The color in her cheeks heightened. Her eyes were dark and brooding.
"What are you doing?"
"Picking corn."
"You're dumping it on the ground."
"So?
What ails you?"
Angrily, Buppy came stomping down the row, bending to pick up the corn Hester had unloaded.
"What got over you?"
she hissed.
"Get that Johnny away from here,"
Hester hissed back.
"Why?"
Hester's face was terrible, her eyes boring into Buppy's with an intensity she had never seen.
"Just do what I said. I mean it."
Buppy rolled her eyes, but she obeyed. Quickly, she loaded the last of the corn onto the wide bed of the wooden wagon, told Johnny to drive, and hopped up behind him, saying Hester would bring the team. Shrugging his shoulders, he could do nothing other than obey. He lifted the reins, hi-yupping to the big, quiet Belgians. Only when the creak of the heavy wheels sounded in her ears did Hester emerge, watching the wagon until it disappeared behind a curtain of overhanging willow branches. Then she stepped out, smoothed down her apron, untied Buppy's gray horse named Silver, and sat heavily on the open seat of the buggy. Johnny had already taken the team of Belgians home by the time Hester had changed into dry clothes, the blue dress and black cape and apron, topped by the muslin fabric of her cap, her face freshly washed. At the curb market, the corn was piled in a high, beautiful bin, green and white at the ends, dewdrops clinging to its dark silk. Carrots lay in bunches, bits of black soil clinging to their thick orange roots. Beside them, the first tomatoes, red-cheeked and inviting, added color to the green, lacy carrot tops. Immediately, the buyers came, pushing, shoving, and carrying away great armloads of corn, wooden crates of it, and cloth bags stuffed full. The coins clinked into the cash box as Buppy yelled and made hand gestures, smiling and dipping her head when the praise became too effusive. Hester talked to perfect strangers, smiling and handing tomatoes and carrots to fat, overdressed housewives and stick-thin women in ruffles, all sweating profusely in the sweltering heat.
"De corn! De corn!"
Beckoning excitedly, her face flushed to a high color, a German housewife plowed through the crowd, elbowing her way through the more well-to-do.
"Step back, watch it there," came snorts of disapproval and words of rebuke, all to no avail. On she came.
De corn, oi, so fresh, so yellow, just picked.
Hester found herself laughing freely, the sound like water rippling over smooth stones. She lost herself in the mad, colorful crowd of pushing people. She heard Buppy's words rising and falling, selling her vegetables. She wasn't quiet, nor circumspect, and certainly not humble. But Hester was carried along by the gaiety, the high spirits that caused Buppy to talk constantly to her customers. Hester smiled without self-consciousness. She spoke to strangers, and she was surprised to find that they weren't strangers after she had spoken to them. She learned from Buppy to be tolerant, happy to let go of her suspicion, her dislike of certain people. To Buppy, they were all the same. They bought her vegetables. Too tired to cook supper, and the house holding the heat like a tea kettle, Hester and Buppy collapsed in the backyard beneath the shade of a wilted lilac bush at the end of the market day. Buppy lay flat on her back, her knees bent upward, poking into the sky, all sharp angles and dark colors. She had thrown one arm over her forehead and was saying they made enough money to buy a house today. Hester lay on her stomach, her chin in her hands, her shoulders shaking as she laughed at Buppy's ridiculous expansion of the coins in the wooden box. A low rumble of thunder grumbled in the distance. The evening sun shone on. "It'll rain," Hester said shortly.
"Nah, what's wrong with you? The sun's shining as bright as ever."
"It'll rain."
"Hey, what is up with you and Johnny? You act like he's as lovable as a snake."
"He is."
"Oh, come on, he's much nicer than William was. Sorry, may he rest in peace."
Hester rolled onto her back, shaded her eyes the way Buppy did, and outright told her about Johnny's misdeeds at Christmas time, the lies that followed, and her own bowing to his wickedness. Buppy pulled a blade of grass, chewing it slowly as she listened. She spit it out, plucked another one, and chewed it the whole way through, then spit it out too. Finally, she said,
"Well, Hester, you in a red dress were probably a sight to see. I'm surprised William allowed it."
"It was his mother's." Up went Buppy's eyebrows.
Ain't that something? Well, just goes to show you never know how men's minds work. I sure never had that problem. No one ever tried to, you know.
Her face turned as red as her largest red beet. "I guess I was too dumb to see."
"Stop blaming yourself. That's why I'm unmarried. You can't judge a book by its cover. You never know if a man is sincere, a good, kind Christian fellow, or a genuine traitor."
Hester nodded. They both fell silent. Another rumble of thunder worried itself on the horizon. The red glow of the evening sun disappeared, leaving them in an eerie, grayish-yellow light. Buppy sat straight up like a jack-in-a-box. Her eyes turned dark and wide with fear. "Rain's coming," Hester said.
Walter Trout's perspiring face popped up over the fence.
"Emma says we have a few corn cakes left, and some molasses and applesauce. If you're hungry, she has a muskmelon cut open for you."
By the time the storm hit, Hester and Buppy sat cozily by candlelight, eating Emma's good food, washing it down with many glasses of cold, sugared spearmint tea. The lightning flashed blue, followed by great rolls of heavy thunder that shook the wooden frame of the house. The wind screamed around the corners, howled under the eaves, and lashed the window panes with sheets of water. A high sound of pinging ice soon followed. Buppy held her hands over her ears and squeezed her eyes shut tightly.
"Oh, my garden! My poor garden!" she said, swaying back and forth as if mourning the demise of all her vegetables. "God is unhappy with us," wailed Emma.
She believed a storm was God's fury on humankind and all its sins, to bring everyone to repentance. Hester sat, tired and relaxed, rocking quietly on the armless rocking chair. Her dark eyes watched the rain and ice punish the glass window panes. She heard the howling of the wind. Unafraid, she knew all humankind was subject to storms, to the ways of the sky, the sun, the moon, the earth. It was all a part of the universe, so much greater and so much more than one mind could begin to grasp. Like the eagle's flight, the storm spoke to her soul. All the earth and the things of the earth could not be separated. Like the weather, everything was controlled by the Almighty Creator. He chose to send storms and heat, cold and wind and drought. If the garden was ruined, they had enough to get by. The harder the hail bounced off the windows, the more agitated Buppy became, mournfully shaking her head and muttering about the green tomatoes and cucumbers, the green beans and squash.
"It'll be gone, all of it ruined. What will we do?"
she wailed, rocking back and forth, misery turning slowly to hysteria. "It'll be all right. Hail is never widespread." These words came from Hester on the rocking chair, her dark eyes untroubled pools of calm.
"How can you say that? You have no idea," shrieked Buppy,
her eyes large and dark with the fear of losing her vegetables and of the wooden box becoming empty of coins before the coming winter was over. A deafening clap of thunder followed sizzling white light as jagged streaks of lightning erupted from boiling black clouds above the town of Lancaster. Winds increased as the storm moved directly above them. Hail rattled the wooden shingles, attacked window panes, jumped on the streets, and nestled in backyard grasses. Then the rain increased its fury. The wind's force soaked every hand-hewn shingle and brought the rain to seep beneath them, then drip steadily onto attic floors. Meticulous housewives squawked, grabbed wooden buckets, and raced pell-mell up their steep attic stairs to find the dripping leaks, placing the buckets at the proper places. Rain seeped down mud and stick chimneys and ran down whitewashed walls. Horses whinnied in alarm, kicking and pounding against the sides of their stalls, their eyes rolling in fright as the sizzling lightning became more constant. A sound reached Hester's ears. She held completely still. A shingle? A loose shutter? Again, the repetitious knocking. She sat up straight. Someone is at the door.
Ach, nay, nay!
Emma, quite distraught, looked to Hester for assistance. Buppy, forgetting her ruined vegetable garden, sprang into action, tearing open the latch. From the narrow hallway came a shriek of surprise, and then an exclamation of sorrow, a sort of mewling edged by the beginning of a sob.
Hester?
The command was so forceful she sprang into action, peering around Buppy's narrow shoulders. There, in the blinding white flashes of lightning, stood a very small boy, holding a bundle almost as big as himself. Drenched, and his sodden bundle dripping water, he turned calm eyes to the incredulous women, but said nothing at all. Behind her, Hester felt the floorboards raise and lower as Walter and Emma lumbered toward them. Buppy turned, unsure. Hester reached out and drew the boy in, as water ran off him in rivulets, pooling at his small feet. She took the bundle amid shrieks from Buppy, the usual half-prayer, half-exclamation coming from Emma. Quickly, she unwrapped the sodden blanket, not surprised to find an infant. A baby. Buppy was squealing about the offensive odor in the rain and puddles on Emma's clean floor and rug. Walter cleared his throat as he shuffled back to the kitchen for rags, shaking his great pink head with the crown of grayish hair circling his ears. He never could expect a normal day since marrying his Emma, not even during a summer thunderstorm. But that was all right. Anything was better than the life of crippling solitude he had led before he met the boisterous Emma. And she was so loving. They carried the children into the heat of the kitchen and dried them with the towels. Their smell was like a mixture of manure, sour grapes, and spoiled cream, the stench thick and cloying. Buppy's anger forced a few surprising words from her mouth. She moved fast, getting down the agate wash tub, then starting a fire in the wash house. Above the howling wind and stinging rain, her voice could be heard commanding and giving instructions. The end result was two shivering children, both like lost kittens, their skin scrubbed, their heads scoured with kerosene, then soaped, rinsed, and soaped again. Wrapped in rough towels, the boys were terrified of the smell, the powerful soap, the water, Buppy's less than gentle hands. The women threw the stained and torn clothing in the backyard. Buppy said she was taking no chances with the likelihood that those clothes had to be crawling with lice. When darkness closed in around the wooden house on Mulberry Street, the storm had moved on. Eaves still dripped. Branches and leaves, torn from sturdy trees by the powerful gusts, were strewn across the streets. Small rivers roiled by, then pooled in low places, filling large holes that set drivers' teeth on edge as the steel-rimmed wheels of their carriages hit them. The quietness that eventually came was a blessing. Buppy rinsed the tubs and set the wash house in order. Hester wrapped a towel around the baby, who seemed to be about a year old, weighing a bit more than she had thought. The older child was perhaps 4. Emma reached for him, rocked and crooned, sang and stroked the small back. Tears came, puddled, then ran down her shining cheeks.
Oh, meine liebe Kinna, meine liebe,
she repeated over and over.
What the Teufel does?
She never blamed any person in circumstances such as these. It was always the devil's fault. He stalked around the town, seeking who he could devour, that cunning Dyfel, Emma would say. Why, just look at the women who were slovenly, the men who chose to waste their wages on liquor and became drunkards, leaving their children to starve and eventually be turned into the streets when irate house owners put them there. When the devil had his way, there was no money for rent, food, or clothing. The women, in despair, turned to the orphanage and left their children there, half mad with fear and anger and hopelessness. None of them could get the 4-year-old to speak. His tears had dried up, but his light-colored eyes remained fixed, stone cold. Those once glittering eyes went to a place none of them could follow. His face was triangular, with a wide forehead, sunken cheeks, and a pitiful pointed chin. His mouth, too wide, held decaying teeth that looked like wormy corn kernels. Hester spoke to him gently in English. She spoke in German, then tried the more common Pennsylvania Dutch. The smaller one continued to wail, sobbing and sniffing. Walter heated a pan of milk, added molasses, and stirred. He put a small portion in a cup, spread butter on brown, crumbly bread, and brought it all to Emma, setting it quietly on the oak washstand beside her rocking chair like a well-trained servant. When Emma patted Walter's arm, her eyes going to his face, her Dankeschön was so filled with love that Hester resolved to someday, if she lived to a ripe old age, feel a love such as they had. Emma offered the milk to the young boy, who grabbed the cup from her hand, sucking and slurping greedily, straining at the sweet milk. It dribbled down the sides of his face and splashed on the towel as he lifted his face to drain every drop. His eyes begged for more, even as his chest caved in, his shoulders tensed, and he leaned forward to purge every ounce of the nutritious liquid. There was a sudden flood on the clean floor. Walter and Buppy turned as one. They found a rag and mopped everything clean. Hester spoke. "That's what happened to me when I was starved on my journey from Berks County. The child is starving like I was. Allow him only a teaspoon at a time. Give him the bread in small bites." Buppy looked at Hester with a rueful shake of her copper-colored head, the hard, gleaming pebbles that were her eyes disappearing behind lowered lids. Emma gave the boy small pinches of bread and butter. She waited until he leaned forward, his mouth open wide, before she allowed him more. His translucent eyes were glittering with desperation, the urge to fill his stomach, to rid himself of the torment that was hunger. Small sips of warm milk, more bread, a bowl of porridge, more porridge. Buppy did not know anything so terrible existed. She was born and raised among the Amish, who lived frugally and whose food was plain and simple, but sufficient. Real hunger had never entered her life. She was incredulous, asking question after question. She pondered the answers. She said that even the Indians, who were supposedly ungodly, provided for their own little ones. This was a shame. "It's the liquor, the homemade stills, the rye whiskey, the fermented apples, the hops, and all the other stuff. They use it to make the devil's brew," Emma said emphatically. Both boys' heads dropped, their eyes lowered, and sleep overtook them. The room became still. Occasionally there was a drip of rain, a sighing of the wind, as if the earth was relieved the storm had moved on. Candles flickered. Deep breathing sounds assured them of the boys' slumber. Emma said quietly, "We'll let them sleep in our bedroom by our bed, just in case they wake up." Reverently, as if Christ were in the room, Walter clasped his hands over his rounded stomach and shook his head up and down. The two women left the hush of Walter Trout's home, returning to the dark, damp interior of their own. They poured cool glasses of tea, and Buppy plied Hester with dozens of questions. Why had she left her family in Berks County? How could she travel all that way? Why wasn't she dead? Far into the night, Hester recounted her story. She left some of the truth out. She told Buppy it was Annie's dislike of her that finally severed the familial cord.
"Like a birth,"
Buppy nodded. In a sense, it was like that. I was free. And yet countless times I have longed to return to the stone farmhouse. To Noah, and Isaac, and Lissy, and Daniel, Solomon, and the baby. I still miss the children.
Were Noah and Isaac good to you?
Hester gazed past the candlelight, her eyes drawn to the black corners of the room, as if secrets were hidden best in the dark recesses. Her eyelids grew heavy with sadness as her mouth became soft with remembering. Her voice was husky with fettered pain, a torture that constricted her will to speak. Before Annie, they were my brothers. She destroyed the loyalty, the ties that bound us.
Then they didn't love you for real if they allowed that woman to come between you.
Hester nodded, her eyes somber. I guess not. Buppy nodded back, drained her tea, set the glass on the table, and got up a bit stiffly, putting a hand to her back.
It's been a long day. I'm off to bed. Ah, life is crazy, Hester. Don't look back, or your plow will go way off course, the way the Bible says. Not that I'm much of a Bible reader, but that one thing is true.
She yawned, stretching like a long, skinny black cat. Hester watched and said, I'm glad you live with me, Buppy.
Hope you'll say the same thing a year from now,
Buppy said, grinning. Chapter 19. The garden stretched before them, green and flourishing and unharmed. The late morning sun slanted through the washed tomato plants. The red fruit was mud-splattered, their stalks tossed and showing the lighter, dusty shade of green underneath. The corn all lay at an angle, its short roots partly exposed, but the ears of corn intact. They stood, two women shading their eyes with their hands, palms down. One, dressed in dark navy blue, was taller, sharper. The other, dressed in green, was tall and willowy, but possessing the figure of a woman. Their skirts rippled. Cap strings lifted, moved, and fell across their shoulders, the clean, fresh breeze of summer playing with them. Hester turned to Buppy, her eyes conveying her pleasure. What did I say? Reluctantly, Buppy answered,
Hail is never widespread.
They laughed. Together they weeded that day, the cool mud squeezing up between their toes, the hems of their aprons becoming brown with it. The sun shone hot but pleasant. Doves hurried across the blue sky, propelled by their triangular wings. Crows wheeled and flapped, their raucous cries grating and unpleasant, on their way to rob other birds' nests if they could. Sometimes Hester broke into song, with Buppy joining in. Mostly, though, they remained quiet, pulling weeds, tossing them aside. They spread a blanket in the shade of a spruce tree and opened the lunch basket between them. Buppy cut a ripe tomato into slices, then laid them warm and sun-kissed on squares of new brown bread, spread with plenty of yellow butter, and sprinkled the slices with salt. They drank cool tea and glasses of buttermilk. Side by side, they reclined on the blanket, resting their backs. Above them, suddenly, a deep laugh, a joyous welcome.
Well, surprise, surprise.
A lilting, slick tone, lifting and falling in all the wrong places. Without thinking or caring, Hester sat bolt upright, her privacy invaded, her happiness destroyed. Black, hostile lights filled her eyes, and her voice sounded like an assault.
Does Naomi know you are here?
Johnny recoiled, looking quickly at Buppy for support. She shrugged her shoulders and kept quiet.
Go home to your family and leave us alone. You have no business out here with us.
Hester did not flinch when Johnny's eyes became bright with anger. She met the light head on, unwavering. For one wild moment, she thought he was going to hit, to lash out with his fist, helplessly flailing the air between them. Instead, he tried to frighten her with his anger, held in check by the regulations of his religion. Still, she did not back down. He turned on his heel, sharply throwing his shoulders back, and stalked off with exaggerated steps, like an irate schoolboy sent to stand in the corner. Hester would not have been surprised to see a rock come hurtling in their direction.
Hoo boy.
Buppy shook her head. He doesn't need to follow us around,
He has wrong intentions.
But still, Hester, he may be trying to make amends.
He's not.
How can you tell?
Hester shrugged her shoulders and went back to work without another word, pulling weeds like someone possessed, without one backward glance in Buppy's direction. The child would not speak. Walter and Emma had tried every available resource to get him to at least tell them his name, some sense of where he had come from, who a relative or parent was. But the boy sat, his eyes giving away nothing, only the greenish-yellow light ringed by brown flecks impossible to decipher. Both children ate every morsel of food given to them. They were clad in a set of Emma's necessaries, meaning a small shirt and pants for the four-year-old and a girl's dress for the baby, all made from flour or feed sacks. Emma always kept a wooden trunk well-stocked, just in case a hungry or homeless person had need of clothing. The baby crawled, but slowly, pulled himself up by his thin little arms and stood, his thumb in his mouth, his eyes wide and frightened. Emma showed Hester the stripes on the older child's back and across his legs where a switch had bitten through the flesh. It had healed, then been cut open time after time. He had angry flea bites and rashes on his elbows and his knees. In the candlelight, they had failed to notice. Emma sighed. One little victim saved for now. They gave up trying to find their home after Walter walked to the constable's office where he was waved away. Repeatedly, he talked to the clerk at the desk, who fixed an impatient stare of resentment on his perspiring face. Finally, he lifted his hat and wished her a good day, losing no time in getting out of that office. Hester and Buppy took it on themselves to try to find the children's home. Taking the boy by the hand, they asked him to come with them. They were going for a walk. His terrified eyes glowered at them. Turning, he zigzagged wildly through the house, finally coming to a stop beneath the table, where he curled into a trembling fetal position, his eyes tightly closed. The baby began wailing, its sobs turning into screams of hysteria. Leaving Emma to comfort the distraught child, they walked out onto the street, more determined than ever to find the source of the children's mistreatment. The town of Lancaster was newly washed, the storm having given the dusty streets and buildings a thorough rinsing. The evening was warm, but not humid, making their stroll a pleasant one. Naturally, they turned toward the more common section of town, where the separate dwellings turned into huts that housed miners, coal shovelers, and migrant workers. Here, the streets were a soup of mud and water. Tired, unkempt mothers peered suspiciously from doorways, swatting at clouds of mosquitoes that swarmed up from the liquid streets. Yelling children clad in mud shot across the roadways, all thin arms and legs with big feet and hands and bellies. A youth sagged against a crooked doorpost, smoking a homemade pipe made from a reed and a corncob. He blew a jet of brown smoke in their direction, coughed, squinted, and spat into the mud before lifting the pipe and inhaling deeply.
"Hello?"
Buppy said, a question more than anything. The youth nodded in their direction.
"Do you have any idea if anyone on your street is looking for their children? Two boys?"
A shrug of the shoulders. His two big shirts slid off one shoulder, leaving his thin white neck exposed, childlike. Too vulnerable.
"Is your mother here?"
"Aren't got no ma."
"Your father?"
"Died 2 days ago, at the foundry."
Buppy perked up, her eagerness bringing her through the puddles of water, the mosquitoes, and the green-tailed flies that buzzed around the filthy doorways.
"Do you have two brothers?"
"Of course not."
"Did anyone else die at the foundry?"
"Two more."
Clearly, they were on the right path. They asked him to take them to the men's families. He said no, they didn't have no families. Defeated, they looked at each other. Feeling dismissed by the disinterested youth, they retraced their steps, lifting their skirts to avoid dragging them through the mud. There were many more streets, but the evening sun was already low in the sky, and both of them had no wish to be here in this corner of Lancaster when darkness arrived. Better to go back home. The squalor, the odor, and raw poverty of the miners' homes kept Hester awake. She thought of the Indians, their uncanny ability to flourish with nothing except what the earth provided. With the gift of trees, they erected their lodges. With stone, they fashioned arrowheads to find food that sustained them. From the wild animals, they fashioned their clothes. They made their tools, in fact, an entire way of life with nothing except the knowledge handed down from generation to generation. They roamed the land, never hungry, always resourceful. So who had gone wrong that intelligent white people should let the poor fall along the wayside? Had the liquor and its alcoholic content become a tradition as well? She considered the Amish, the Mennonites, the Dunkards, the conservative groups who cared for their own. They had the poor among them always, but not like this. Constantly they gave, they fossarked, they cared for any less fortunate than themselves. She supposed she had always been sheltered from the depravity of humankind, the ignorance and unfairness. How could a row of shacks come to be? On that street? What kept the people in poverty? Over and over her mind mulled, searching for a reason that all of God's children were not the same. Perhaps God does love unequally. Otherwise, how could he allow these little ones to suffer untold terrors? Hans seemed so much better, his shortcomings so different in the way he loved her and ignored the boys, Noah and Isaac. In spite of all that, he provided shelter and food and instilled a work ethic, teaching them to be self-sufficient, to work the land, fell trees, milk cows, and train horses. The list went on and on. So much of Han's weakness was her fault. Hadn't she always thought so? As time went on, that idea became firmly entrenched within her. It was easier to handle the past if she lived as the one who had done wrong somehow. The same with William. She had failed miserably. Her own sense of unworthiness unrolled like a scroll, the writing not quite legible, but unmistakably there in black and white. To stay alert, to stay away from men, was her new and immediate goal. It was the only way to fix her past, to stop making mistakes. She would grow herbs and make tinctures with Buppy's help. Together they would tend to the sick, erase the miserable huts, and teach the men and women to clean and cook, to grow vegetables, grind corn, and make their own bread from wheat kernels. Hester flipped on her side and punched her pillow. She was awake completely now by the passion that drove her thoughts, the tumbled possibilities, the lessons she learned from Emma, good kind soul that she was. Together with Buppy, they would roll up their sleeves and make a big difference in the lives of the poor. For starters, Buppy did not need to throw away the leftover cabbage leaves or the few tiny carrots half hidden in the loose soil in the bottom of the wooden crate. Red beet tops were very good cooked with salt, pepper, and a dash of vinegar. Buppy threw them away, which Hester found extremely wasteful, but so far she had kept quiet. Kate had used every last wrinkled pea pod, every little nubbin of corn. She packed away late green tomatoes to roll later in flour and fry in lard. "It'll taste good in the cold winter," she would say, her eyes merry as she shucked that last pitiful ear of corn. This week after market, Hester would crate all the outer cabbage leaves, the red beet tops, anything she could salvage. She saw the row houses every time she closed her eyes. She felt the hopelessness. Why was the boy lolling about in the late afternoon when he should have been at work the way farm lads were? What caused these people to live in desolate clusters of shacks when less than a half mile away wealthy families lived in opulence, black servants seeing to their every need? She thought again of the Amish and their stringent work ethic. They, the Mennonites, the Dunkards, and many of the more liberal English worked hard to establish farms, clearing entire forests to make room for rolling fields of crops. Maybe no one had taught these poor families how to garden or save money. Hester's heart beat faster. Her pulse quickened with the daring plan that formed in her mind. Yes, she would start one family at a time. The summer would soon be over. This is what she would do. With her store of herbs and the wisdom she had learned from the old Indian woman, she would heal the sick children and teach the destitute women to cook, clean, and wash clothes. She hoped Bappy would agree to help her. Outside, in the warm summer night, a figure crept past Hester's bedroom window. tiptoeing stealthily, bent over, a dark figure with his face hidden. He stopped, then slid his hand along the German siding as if to test the sturdiness of it. For a long time he stood, his face lifted, white and featureless in the dark night, with only the ineffective light from the stars overhead. Hester turned, her dreamlike edge of sleep disturbed by a sound she could not place. A sliding or slithering? A brush against stone? If she were in the forest, she would have known, but here in town, she could not place it. She sighed, untroubled, and let sleep overtake her. Back in the verdant garden the following day, Hester straightened her back, met Buppy's eyes, and said, "This fall, when the cold weather approaches, we will go to the poorhouses, you and I." Buppy's elevated eyebrows rearranged her freckles.
"We will?"
Hester nodded. She lifted a hand to tuck a strand of hair beneath her cap. "I think God wants me to do this. This might be why I was led to this town. I have all these herbs and the knowledge of how to use them." Buppy's face turned a shade darker, obliterating the freckles. Her eyes snapped with anger, black and abrasive.
"Hester, you think you're going to solve poverty once and for all with a musty box of stinking herbs? Don't you know the reason those people live like that? They're lazy. The men don't care. They sit down at those taverns and drink away any wages they earn. It's hopeless."
Buppy sniffed and mopped her brow with her gray handkerchief. Hester's mouth turned down. Her nose tingled as her breathing became fast and shallow. "You say that because it leaves you free and blameless. The Amish are soaked with that attitude. You sound exactly like Francis and William." The words were out before she could think of their consequences. Buppy straightened to her tallest height, her eyes wide and bulging with the scratching truth of Hester's words, an uncomfortable affront to her own righteous life. She stamped one bare foot.
You are such an Indian in your strange way of thinking," she burst out, her cap strings flapping, then coming to rest across her shoulders.
Hester faced Buppy squarely. "Yes, I am an Indian. After seeing the squalor and destitution of poor white people, I am glad. Glad. The Indians have no money, only a priceless heritage handed down to them from their forefathers. That's just like the Amish. They are self-sufficient in so many ways, making a good way of life with only the things God has created. I am proud of my Indian blood for the first time in my life, and it feels good." Buppy's mouth hung open in surprise. "You can think what you want. I defend my ancestors and the way they live." Buppy snorted.
"I guess you defend the Ohio massacres, the scalping, the savages plundering and burning homes. Those Indians are worse than animals."
"Because they were driven to it by the white men's greed for land." This Buppy could not truthfully deny. "The Indians roamed these Pennsylvania woods peacefully, and you know it." Buppy nodded. Hester continued. "All my life, I have worn my Indian heritage like an abnormal growth, ashamed of it. No more. Seeing the little boys, realizing the cruel, depraved way they were beaten." Hester shook her head. Buppy looked off across the garden to the woods beyond. She shaded her eyes with a hand. The palm turned down, watching the flight of a meadowlark. Suddenly she turned.
"Let's not quarrel about something so unnecessary."
"For you, maybe, but not for me. I know for the first time that I do not have to go through life feeling ashamed of who I am. I want to be able to use the knowledge handed to me by an old Indian woman. Many herbs that grow in these fields and swamps and forests are priceless. They heal. They are good for so many things." Buppy held very still.
"Listen."
From the edge of the woods, by the meandering little creek, came the sound of whistling. At first, the women thought it was an unusual bird, till Hester shook her head. Somewhere, she had heard the whistle before. It was more than blowing air through lips the way Hans and Lissy would whistle. It was a sad, captivating tune. It brought tears to her eyes so many years ago, and it did again.
"Someone is down there,"
Buppy said, her eyes wide, her hands knotted into fists. "Sounds like it," Hester agreed. Warily, they stood still, their ears straining to hear the unusual sound coming from below them.
"Wish we had some sort of protection, like a gun," Buppy murmured.